generation? Shall we perish unjust or live equal as a nation?
Live from Hudson, this is WTXC Accra.
Oh dear, I really want to go upstate.
Well, gotta put some gas in the car, you know, they're still rationing down here.
Oh honey, I wanna go up and see the 20-somethings upstate. They can't get jobs and they're not washed. I'm going to bring a washcloth and a bit of my favorite lavender soap.
Oh, I love that lavender soap, honey. It really smells delicious on you.
Oh, think of how it will smell on the 20-somethings. They are so cute when they're sleeping in their cars.
Battlefield Earth, every Tuesday night from 9:30 to midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM.
I hope that I can find the answers to the question life keeps asking.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Scribner's Catskill Lodge, a 38-room boutique hotel located in Hunter, offering a seasonal outdoor pool, weekend wellness programming, and nightly s'mores around the fire pits. Located at 13 Scribner Hollow Road, across the street from Hunter Mountain, 8 miles from the Forest Trails in Catskill Park, and 22 miles from the town of Woodstock. Scribner's is also home to the Prospect Restaurant and Bar, serving modern fare. Information at 518-628-5130 or at www.scribnerslodge.com.
Good afternoon. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley on WGXC 90.7 FM on your radio dial here in Green, Columbia counties in Catskill, Accra, and Hudson. And I'm your host for the Art of the Hudson Valley. My name is Chad Weckler. And today we are interviewing Francine Hunter McGivern. She has a two-part installation here at the Hudson Hall at the historic Hudson Opera House. In fact, that's where we are today, doing a remote interview. And I'm looking around at the exhibition. And frankly, if you want to see this installation part one, it concludes this Saturday, and then we get into the second installation and a lot more surprises. And here is Francine. Hi, Francine.
Good morning, Chad.
So, what was your inspiration for installation one and then later installation two?
Well, initially, I'd like to thank Tambra Dillon and all the women on the staff here at the Hudson Hall for this incredible opportunity to share my life and work. And my husband, Daniel Rothbart, whose love and support, you know, 21 years has encouraged. Mm. And Tambra came to the studio. I had a 35-year sort of a survey installed in the lower floor of the building, trying to get back to my own work after the five-year CR10 Arts project ended, which was a conceptual project around investigating the Kunsthal in the 21st century. Of course, we know there's no function, but moving forward, Tambra, you know, just enjoyed the visit, and she repeated a number of times, "There's so much. There's just so much. There's so much." And that was the beginning of the so much, which I spent a year going through, given the opportunity of collaborating with the site, the historic Hudson Opera House, which is the groundwork of my work, is site-specific in its sense of response to a space, to architecture, light, particularly negative space, and then the space between that comes from what you put somewhere, what do you see in, around, or through. So that was the beginning, and it was a long year of an enormous investigation through an obsessive lifetime of archiving and creativity, which I have all archived in my CR10 building in a very obsessive, organized museum archive. So much of it I hadn't looked at for a long, long time. So this was an opportunity to finalize, in the sense of installation and site-specific, all the work is there, all the elements are there, all the multimedia is there, but the way in which you contextualize around an idea, and then you draw out all the elements just as if you're building anything, and then you put it into that site, that grid, and the works have their own lifetime around that placement. So the process was extraordinarily engaging and challenging, because the building here is historic, so you can't put anything into the wall. And so that became a determining factor in the design and development of a site-specific installation. Probably midway through examining and editing the content of so many different multidisciplinary expressions of my work since 77, which is the show here, the parenthetical. So it was really an idea that came to me about cinematic. It was a film. It was a moving dialogue with a narrative imagery. And so that, given my groundwork in performance, which was all done for a video document, you know, that was circular in a way. And then it was kind of a title of that film was Episodic Memory. And so I was challenged. I didn't want it to be the 40-year trajectory. I didn't want it to be, what do we call that? One after the other. What is that word? Consecutively. Or what? Chronological. I didn't want it to be chronological. So then, you know, each challenge represented so many different dimensions. Back to the space, the light, the limitations, the amount of work, the selecting within the space. And then the titles kind of, you know, came out of, really, I would say, a philosophical ground in the metaphysics of language, really, like how language is a symbol, semiotic. So To Rule Truly is actually a reference to one of the 64 hexagrams in the I Ching, which is a big part of my underlying focus. There's only a few subjects that I repeatedly visit. But that was, you know, something in Jungle Red Studios that became kind of like the message. So I always perceived myself as kind of a cipher. And
Did Jungle Red start in 1977?
Yes. I started Jungle Red Studios in a small apartment on 16th and 7th across from Barney's, very fortunate for shopping, shoe shopping. And you know, I just had this connection to the record industry from many friends. So I was working for record labels doing, you know, record covers, and I had a few good friends there. I didn't know too many people at that time. But I'd go out every night to all the clubs and hand out this little Xerox. And so, you know, that was the beginning of it. And it was kind of a plan I had from around 76 to come back to New York and start this thing. And I had a friend who was going to do it with me, but she was an old groupie, Pamela Fox Manning, a brilliant woman who guided me through a lot of incredibly great times. But she, you know, fell in love and got married. So I, you know, wanted to have this kind of club for women, like a private club for women, where they could indulge themselves in feeling fabulous, and services, and, you know, dialogue, and their libertine lives. And so having retired from the sex industry, you know, I had a lot of experience as a madam. Although I never took that role in the biz, but you're your own madam in your own theater all day long. So it was all about Andy Warhol. It was Art Imitates Life. Mm. So it was about the factory as kind of a structural kind of approach. Art Imitates Life, okay, I'll paint these people's portraits for a whole pile of money, and then I'll go make some trashy movie with Joe D'Alessandro. I mean, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul. It seemed like a really good pragmatic and approach to supporting your life as a creative individual, and also the development of the entrepreneurial in the way in which it does kind of inform your creative life.
I would say, thinking back, because I was in New York City at the same time in the 70s, a lot of now professional filmmakers started in adult films.
Oh yes, particularly if you look into the AIDS crisis, the amount of people that we lost who were really like pioneers in the way in which we chose to be very, very on the front line of sexual freedoms and the mind-body liberation of expression, you know, of, like I say, turn them upside down, they all look alike. Nobody cared. It was a very different time around, you know, experiencing in the Jungian way, what's right in front of you, and I'm going to go for it. You know what I mean? And be present. And so, yes, I think that those 70s period, you had, you know, different approaches to how you would survive. I personally, you know, grew up in a very sophisticated Irish Catholic bunch of, you know, wackos that were all brilliant, extraordinarily productive, and very entrepreneurial, both mother and father. And I'm one of six children, and very dysfunctional, and I was pretty much groomed as a debutante in those types of schools and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, by the time I was like in my late teens, it was kind of my way or the highway, and I just said adios to all of that and took the sharpest left I could and ended up, I don't know where I haven't ended up yet, but there were a lot of travels, on the road travels, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco after a long story of, you know, being arrested on a school bus in Manhattan with a bunch of people. And, you know, we weren't really the hippie types. We were more the hardcore kind of like bikers and girls that were going to work in the strip clubs and the go-go bars and blah, blah, blah. So there was that about it. So, you know, my parents thought I was a little too wild to go to art school, believe it or not. So they were not encouraging me. So I went to some Tony school in Washington, where I got thrown out as early as possible for, you know, a three-day acid trip, and that I was like said to the Reverend Mother, you know, listen, I just don't think I can make it back to school until, Mari, what time did we drop? Oh, yeah, I think probably by 6:30 or 8 tonight I could be back on campus. So, you know, they didn't know what to do with me. I had a radio show. I had a radio show in Georgetown, and I had one of my first nom de arte of the radio show, Carla LaFong. Capital C, small a, small r, small l, small a. Capital L, small a. Capital F, small o, small n, small g. LaFong, Carla LaFong. From a W.C. Fields movie that I copied that. And I played like a lot of blues, and I was very, you know, in the music world. And so from then, I just kind of found a way to support myself as an independent woman, worked for all those mafia people, and ultimately connected with a group of very fabulous women who just, you know, worked as call girls and independent in a group. And, you know, it was a very free time, you know. And I just lived my own life. I had a lot of pragmatic sensibility that I garnered from my father and mother and grandparents. So work ethic was huge. So I liked working.
And you're a native New Yorker?
Born in Manhattan, East 49th Street in the Polyclinic Hospital. And then my parents, they had moved there from Boston. And my my mother's father went to MIT, and he built the New Deal poured cement water reservoirs. He designed and built those in the Northeast. So after my parents got married, my father, who had come out of the war, got a veteran scholarship to, a scholarship to Harvard. And he studied political science. Previously, he'd gone to Emerson and studied music and theater, so he was a brilliant musician. But he got a degree, summa cum laude, and like he was the class of Kennedy, and, 44, I believe, yeah. And so he just kind of got this job working for my mother's father with a political science background. My grandfather had an office here in Manhattan, and they moved here. And my brother was born there in Boston, and then I was born here. And then my dad left my grandfather, and they moved to Hicksville for a while, and then he moved to the Midwest and started his own company. And he designed and manufactured ways of purifying water and sewage. So he built a lot of water and sewage plants, really as an early ecologist, and patented all those things. And he and my mom kind of had this business together. And then they had six kids, and it became a mess. But my dad was just like a huge inspiration in my life. Very focused, very much. He was a championship golfer. He was a supreme gin player. You know, he loved gin. Mm. And, you know, so he was like a real kind of Irish inspiration all my life for me about, you know, be you. Just got to be you. Got to be you. You got to get some money. Mm. Pay for your ideas. Develop your ideas. So when I started Jungle Red, I asked him to borrow some money to take over the lease on the DeBrosa Street first Jungle Red real location. And it was the days where you had to buy the fixtures. Mm. And it was $20,000. So I asked my dad if I could borrow. He made me write a business plan.
Good.
And submit it and have it reviewed by his, you know, accountant and blah, blah, blah. And that continued even to the second one where I had to borrow more money and I had to pay it all back. And, you know, it was a really great gift about how you get the money to pay for the life that you want to live on your own terms. Work.
So he was your patron.
He was my mentor. He was my inspiration. He was my soul brother. You know, I mean, he was funny. He had this sign in the bar that said, "I'd like to help you out. Which way did you come in?" And, you know, he had an incredible sense of humor and very kind of introverted. But, and my mother was just like this couture model with, you know, the house was filled with Dior and Balenciaga, and they entertained a great deal. And it was just, it was kind of like a 24-hour Tennessee Williams play over at my house. So the group, the collaborative, the conversations, the extended family, the travel. So a lot of that is kind of in the work, the collaborative, the collective, the process that comes out of how do you find yourself within but without. So you can integrate in the group and remove yourself from the group. So that kind of existential choice, I would say definitely was a gift from my family background, which was extraordinarily dysfunctional.
Great launching pad.
Oh, yeah, I launched. You know, I launched. And they were both very proud of me, you know, during different periods of my life. But mostly I didn't speak to them for quite a long time. Yeah. I remember when People Magazine did this feature on me, my dad was dying of cancer. And, this woman named Wendy, she came, she invited me over. She laid a lot of Coke out on the table and opened some bubbly. And then she knew me from the club scene. And I just released all the splendor that right around that interview. And they loved it at People. And Harry King came and took the pictures. And then they were writing the story, and they called me up, and they loved it. It was like Poor Little Rich Girl or whatever, hilarious. They loved it. My dad told me, "Do you really think I want to have people read that trash online at the supermarket, Francis?" I was like, "What kind of trash?" "Well, I can imagine what you told them." "I didn't tell them anything, Bob. Don't worry about it." I didn't tell them that much. I got on the phone, I called People Magazine like every day, trying to get the editor. Please, my dad is dying. He really does not want to read this. Could we just leave out a couple of these parts? And they were like, no, 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 we love this story.
Oh.
So after a few months, believe it or not, this really fierce person on the phone who was like part of the editorial went, I mean, it was like a four-letter word, you know, you, and it's in the trash. And hung up the phone.
Oh, my.
And I was just, like, rejoicing. You know what I mean? It was just, like, such a lesson for me. Mm. The whole story from the beginning to the end about, you know, the right thing happened. And I learned to keep my mouth shut. Because it was my first, what we would call... It was my first really national publicity. I'd had a massive amount of underground attention and appreciation where we were just all going to tell it like it is. But that was a new level for me.
Now, Details Magazine would have been a perfect venue for you.
This was even before Details. This was 1980, early in 1980. So Details was kind of just starting out. They were all a big part of the life we shared, you know. Annie Flanders and Stephen Sabin, who just recently passed away, genius. All of the people that worked there, Alan Platt. I mean, so many brilliant people. It was Marcus Leatherdale did The Hidden Identities, of which there's one of me in the box. You know, Cookie wrote her column, Cookie Mueller. They were all collaborative kind of gestalts. Each of those little entities, each club, each publication, each underground magazine. So I think everything from the period that I like to share in the exhibition is about the collaborative, which doesn't mean that you're a sociopath, and it doesn't mean that you're a narcissist, and it doesn't mean that you need a pat on the back. It means that you need to engage in your own creative expression of self by connecting with others. So you give and you receive. So that exchange is what was so powerful about the period. And also people traveling from LA to New York and New York to LA. So from like 75 to 82, a lot of people came and went, came and went, came and went. So some people who'd gone to LA in 76, I didn't meet them till they came back in 79. And I had a gift, thanks to my family background, of diplomacy and manners and being able to host and being able to create, you know, environmental grace and kind of make people comfortable. So I had that, which was a big part of how I was able to support myself as a freelance person in TV and music industry and underground films. And so I had a freelance life that brought money into this Jungle Red Studios development where I had the staff, and then with Kenny, my partner, Ken Angelico, my creative partner, we had the line of couture, and then so it grew from the collaborative. So I was very much interested in connecting people. So a lot of the performance and a lot of the underground events that I produced and staged and wrote and performed in as part of, you know, the Times, that brought people from many different worlds, uptown, downtown, which most people were below 14th Street. They didn't have particularly a network outside of the 14th. And so it was kind of closed. But I had a bigger life in terms of the entrepreneurial financial part of supporting my life, my creative life, and building the studio. So that brought a lot of people down. And that was a cool thing. They met each other. They went on and did a million things together. And we all went on and did a million things together. And nobody ever got paid. And nobody expected to get paid. I mean, you'd give people cab money and drinks and whatever. But it was just about doing stuff.
Was Jungle Red had hours? Or was it sort of a private studio? Or did you have people come in off the street?
Well, Jungle Red Studios from 79, when I took this penthouse loft in Tribeca, it was about 2,600 square feet on the top floor with 16-foot ceilings and like six huge skylights about one block from the river. So it had an old freight elevator. It had been the Romanoff Caviar, very large conglomerate of buildings built in the late 1800s that was six contiguous buildings that shared one heating system, which was very unique in the loft law. Anyway, I took the floor and rebuilt and designed the floor and had hired slowly other people. And so it was regular hours, but by appointment only. And, you know, they had to come up in the freight elevator. So mostly people had to know somebody. But, you know, like this sort of patchwork quilted card catalog over there, you know, people had cards. They'd write their numbers. They'd connect with you. You'd give them their card. They'd call up. They'd make an appointment. They'd come. They'd tell people. And it kind of went from there. So it wasn't easy to get there. You had to know somebody, definitely. But aside from that, if you didn't, you know, the elevator wasn't working, you had to walk up six flights, which was me every single night after like 5 a.m. when I did my club crawl after I closed the door of my job. And, you know, and that was another whole life. So it was parallel universes, very, very, very principled business ethics, very professional. I had trained with Sassoon, whatever, follower. And so, you know, we were very, very focused on the quality of everything. And then over time, I built the business and had other people with other skills come in, and that I was there in that space until 1984. And then I just wanted my own studio and my own home back. So I took a place on Franklin Street between Hudson and Greenwich. It was about a 3,000 square foot ground floor at 178 Franklin. And I designed and built that studio. And it had kind of a boutique with different 15 different designers, including Ken Angelico for Jungle Red Studios. And in the old loft and in the space, I did a lot of art exhibitions of people. I did a lot of performance with other people performing. Had a lot of events that were all kind of invitation only in the first DeBrosa Street. And then, starting in the late 70s, you know, I started to collect contemporary art through the people that I met in the really. On 16th Street when people started to refer people to me. I think that was probably after I did the night school performance designed to teach you a lesson theater piece in the Mutt Club. And so a lot of people, particularly like Anthony McCall, was in night school, and he referred Joseph Kasuth and Keith Sonier to come and visit me on 16th Street. They came together one day. And Keith was all in white, and Joseph was all in black, and they had just returned from a show they'd done with Leah Ruma in Naples, their gallery there. And so from that day forward, they were two of my biggest mentors and closest friends, and I learned so much from them and followed them along the path of the contemporary art world. They both showed with Castelli. And so through that, you know, I really built this kind of approach to learning contemporary art through the people that I knew who came to Jungle Red. And that became the basis of beginning to collect. So I started collecting the works of these people who were patrons and friends of Jungle Red. And that was kind of my arts education in art history. And that also informed my performance work, because there was no way I was going to be competing with the Castelli group of people. Most, they were all like 7, 8 years older than I was. But not having gone to art school, you know, my exposure to contemporary art was really Andy, and it was film, and it was music, because if you weren't in New York, you really only had museums or pop culture. So the pop culture of film, video, the narrative, the underground, the pop, all of that really kind of really gave me kind of a platform to express what was I going to make. So knowing my relationship with those artists, being like really like learning and informed by the path that I was given to follow, then, you know, and I asked them if they would barter, and so they all had accounts at Jungle Red, and their assistants and their families and their partners and people were all on the account, and then I would go to the studio and choose a work. So I have an amazing collection of contemporary art from that decade of 78 to 90 and a few additions since then. But I do have of course, the account book of all the artists and all the times they came and the whole, you know, I have everything, all of it. A lot of archiving.
Would you call this the Jungle Red Room?
No, I just call it all episodic memory. To rule truly is to serve, which goes back to why did I come up with that? Well, you know, that was the beginning of like, I started to practice Buddhism in 77. So it was free shrinkage. And, you know, I had a lot of stuff to sort out, like everyone. And, you know, I would say I was not really an ambitious person, but I'm very, very competitive with myself. I was a kind of an Olympic swimmer until I was about 18. But I wasn't really like a competitive type in that world. So I never really was competitive. But with myself, I, you know, ultimately the other side of to rule truly is to serve. Give is the giving is the getting, and learning from that and that kind of experience moved on to me at this age, cranky, critical, and conscious. So that kind of really was the parenthetical around the episodic memory. So again, back to, I didn't want it to be a chronological. So it just became around design, and it became around color and light. And the architecture back to the site, like, you know, putting a lot of things out and then where are they going to go? So it was all drawn out many times on, you know, graph paper and measured every wall. My assistant, Ryan Bartel, who I just couldn't have done anything with, a wonderful, generous, bright, smart, intuitive man who's a painter himself. And I couldn't have done this. So we worked pretty much 3 months packing it and noting it and designing each position of each place. And then we were given 3 weeks to install. So I don't think, I mean, there's work in here that's from 77, and there's work in here that's from 79 and from 1990, 92, 94, 2017. The vitrines are kind of their own ephemeral walk through history that is my own private personal life in a way as a public person. So the private and the personal kind of thing, the private, the public. But I've always been, even though I was highly socialized, I've always been an extraordinarily private person. So the stage was liberating for me because there was a space between the people and me. And there were so many people in my life that were just so instrumental in, oh, girlfriend, put this on and get out there and do your thing. And they were just so encouraging. Like, so I grew up in the 70s with all the drag people up in, you know, the Coquettes I knew in San Francisco in 69. And Ken Angelico, you know, was a big part of the drag scene in 70, 71. There was a club called The Other Side in Boston, run by an old queen named Sylvia Sidney, who took the name from, you know, Hollywood. And so it was just like, that was in the early 70s. So I had exposure to that community of people being expressive about all of their, you know, identification of freedom before, and thank God, gender and identity came into an, you know, existential world. So they were all very encouraging. And so I just started as a, you know, writing shows. I think the first big show I did was Night School. And they invited all these other people who were all well-known artists, Cookie Mueller, Nan Golden, you know, Ken Angelico, so many people, Millie Yatro, Max Blagg, many of whom are dead, Kenny, Gennaro Palermo, you know, so many people. And of course I have it on video. And in the second installation, there's a beautiful slideshow that was put together for an exhibition a few years ago that Daniel, my husband, just did high def. It's 250 images, really incredible. So that will be shown in the VIP Jungle Red Review Lounge in the second installation. The video, I have such a massive archive. I had my first video camera in 79, which is in the vitrine, low-light Panasonic camera. And it was the first low-light Panasonic camera. So as you notice the low light in the burlesque show, the Jungle Red Review, somebody was commenting to me who'd seen the show, you know, it's a shame that the sound is like very not very clear and it's so dark. I'm like, girlfriend, did you ever hear of VHS? Like, it doesn't have a mic and there aren't speakers and you don't have a sound person and you just turn the camera on and get what you can. So I have so much from all the clubs, all the shows I did, participated in, other people that were part of the performative, you know, group of family, you know, wackos that we all put each other in each other's shows. And so I have a massive archive that over the last 2 years I've spent digitizing. I've pretty much gotten through the VHS, the three-quarter I haven't done yet. I haven't done the Super 8s. But, you know, I'm working on possibly doing screening of all of that work. Walter Sudol and Stephen Johnson of the Second Ward, two brilliant collectors who are just the most generous people and smart. And they've offered to host it in collaboration with the Hudson Hall, probably after the show comes down. Because that's a lovely room to screen things.
Yes.
And that's its own medium. And, you know, it would have cluttered up this space. So I had to select no video that way, just one show. And that Jungle Red Review, the burlesque show that I did in 88, that's the last time I performed live. And, you know, I was 38 and, you know, it's a funny show. And I'm glad I have it as a document because it pretty much tells you all the 17 personalities that I go in and out of once I get up in a on a platform with the space between me and the people. So, you know, that that was a lot of fun. And my friend Peter Reed, who passed away from AIDS, he was a brilliant choreographer. He had a dance theater company. We did a lot of projects together. He directed the actual striptease, which I wanted to be an homage to, you know, the early striptease, which is what I grew up with, real burlesque. And then Kenny made that incredibly beautiful costume for me, and he was so ill, he died a few months later. He couldn't see the show, but the costume is there in the Jungle Red Review VIP Lounge, along with the beautiful motorcycle jacket with an oil painting done by another brilliant man named Rags, Michael Rags Raglan, who painted an oil painting of a portrait. It was my 8x10 from when I was in acting and doing small roles in film and when I was like, you know, decided to study the method after I don't know how many years of 20 years of performing really bad backroom stuff. I decided to go to some method class. So anyway, he painted that beautiful portrait that's in the room and he passed away from AIDS too. And his partner, Benjamin Liu, whose name in the our performative theater group was Ming Baz. He was from Chinese descent, and he was Andy's assistant for quite a long time with Paige Powell. There was a whole bunch of people from my generation that kind of looped into who worked at the factory after kind of the Ronnie Catrone and the Mark Ballard and that kind of generation. So a lot of young people, Glenn O'Brien, you know, a lot of that kind of switched over and people in my world were there. I actually had lunch in the factory once with Andy, and I was seated next to Georgette Klinger, who was just this like cosmetic magnate. But I have a photograph, I have a Polaroid of the night I met Andy. And it was in a small apartment of David Armstrong, a brilliant photographer who I knew from Boston Museum School through Kenny and Nan Golden. And they were all part of that world. They all kind of moved down to New York a little after I did. And before I did, David came, and then I came, then Nan came. And so we were like a whole, they were a lot of museum. They were younger, but we were all very close. And I had this friend at the time, Juan Sanchez Juarez, and he goes, and he said, "There's Andy. Go introduce yourself." He's a painter. He lived with Max Blagg. They had this loft, and we were all in this party. "There's Andy. Go!" I said, "Oh, no way!" I was just so in awe. But somebody took a Polaroid of me, and I have it. That night, that was as good as I could get to archiving the memory of Andy. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't a big talker. What are you going to go and say, "Hi, Andy"? Hi. Loved all that.
In the main hall, when people come in to the Opera House here, how would you describe the art that's presented?
Well, that body of work it's the first time that body of work has been shown publicly. It's called My Body Paints, My Brain Bleeds. And it's a body of work I started in the mid-90s when I was about 44, and I was in a long-term relationship with an Italian man named Adolfo Bella, who was a brilliant influence and the most beautiful human in my life that just gave me so much about nature. He was from Positano. I met him on a vacation. I was going to be traveling with Cookie Mueller, but she had a stroke. I already had the tickets. She'd been there many years. She met her husband there, Vittorio Scarpati, on the beach club owned by Adolfo Bella called Da Adolfo. So I had to go. She gave me the tour. You go here for breakfast, here for light coffee, to get on this boat, go down the coast, get off, lunch, the ocean, the people, small little place. Adolfo blew this like hole out in a big, huge rock and built a kitchen in there in the 60s, and everybody went there, Warhol, all the filmmakers. It was a very cool place. It was very rustic. And Adolfo was born in Positano, and Sicilian father, and the mother was from Praiano. And he had been a soldier of Mussolini, ultimately in Crete. He'd been imprisoned by the Germans when they took over the island of Crete from the Italians. He escaped, he survived, he was a very, very legendary, courageous partisan who found his way by foot from Albania up to the north of Parma. And he and these three other dudes blew up this bridge in Borgataro, which was the main transport bridge for the munitions across northern Italy. And over the course of the 9.5 years that I lived with him, I met him at his restaurant. You know, I was there for a month. He invited me to dinner one night, and that was it. He invited me to come back, go to Greece with him. And for 9.5 years, I lived in Positano and Rome. I had an apartment in Rome. I came and went from my house in New York. So the life was very transformational because you're in a volcanic field of very little earth. So it's air and water. So the metaphysics of what came to you in the dream state and blah, 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 it was just transformative for me. In 1994, we were in a head-on collision, Adolfo and I, on the Amalfi Coast. He had a little Cinquecento. We were going down to Ravello to have a lunch and hang out, and he loved nature. We spent all of our time walking. Every day he'd get up and he'd take me to a path that he'd grown up on. He'd walk from Amalfi all the way to Sorrento in those days, delivering a telegram. He told me the first time he went to, you know, deliver, what's his name, the writer who lived in Ravello, you know, that brilliant guy, I can't remember. But long story short, we were in a head-on collision. We survived. I crashed into the light. Adolfo was 70 when I met him, and I was 39. He had a lot of children that were older than me, but they didn't get it, but so that was difficult, but c'est la vie, and you know, they all had their own lives. So Adolfo had a pacemaker. He was about 82 maybe then. I went through the windshield. We got, long story short, I was diagnosed with epilepsy at the age of 4. So a lot of my life has been informed by a gift, which was about being out of body. And so even though it looks as though I'm a very physically grounded person, all of these tableaux of feminist kind of roles of power and women's idea of power, not men's, and the kind of the goddess and the ancient in the female anthropology, the female sexuality, all of that informed my work, clearly, from the grounding of how I started as a free woman and supporting myself. So when that, so I was given a lot of medication, which was all bad, and then I gave all that up, and probably when I smoked pot, and, you know, I'd gone to this French-speaking cloistered convent school of the Sacred Heart, Eden Hall, where I lived for about 2.5 years in this incredible, you know, private school where I got the best education from these French-speaking nuns, but we were only allowed out six hours a week. But somebody's brother had some pot and, you know, brought in whatever, 65. So I didn't take any of that medication. And I never had convulsive seizures where I was threatened by swallowing my tongue. But the convulsiveness was very much a part of the whole, you know, syndrome. But it wasn't life-threatening. And my mother was very compassionate and never made me feel that it was an unusual thing. It was just, you know, something you deal with. So after that accident, I had regular seizures, even on all the medication. And I saw a lot of things from the out-of-body all my whole life. I was always counting. Everything was a grid. I was always looking for a way to get in to the space that I was standing in, or lying in, or sitting in, or looking from. And when that accident happened, 94, I started to have multiple seizures, which had never happened to me ever in my life at that age, 44. And I had to, I went to some doctors in Naples and blah, 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 and then in the end, I had to fly back to New York to see some other doctors. So on the way, Keith Saunier gave me a girlfriend of his name at the time. She had an apartment in Paris. I'd never been to Paris. I go, okay, I'm going to stop on the way to Paris, on the way to New York, and stay with her. So I walked around Paris for a couple of days. I wasn't very well, but, you know, I took it slow. And you know they have those public toilets there where you just got a hole in the ground with some really cheap toilet paper, right? Like little brown pieces like that. And I got my period in the bathroom that day. And that whole body of work came to me about what, you know, it was like body-mind. It was like my mind was not, I was not in my body for these months before that. But my body was there. And, you know, I had these pieces of paper with the blood stains on them. And I looked at them and it was kind of like having this decoded Rorschach experience of what is your body other than the conduit, a cipher, and, you know, a glyph for your entire existential permeation, you know? And so I had this idea, of course, I saved the toilet paper, and then this piece here, those are the X-rays that were taken when I got off the plane and went to the doctor. So that became the first of it, where I had this idea of I would go into this idea, the Baroque, the fold, a book that Terry Winters referred me to in 1994 or 1990, sometime when I'd started to make this work. Terry came to the studio. I'm a huge fan and appreciator of his work and very conscious, sensitive individual. So I was hesitant to show people the work, but Terry came to the studio and saw some of the work in the studio, and that was his response, The Fold, this book written by Jill Deleuze, which is about Leibniz's kind of study around how the mathematics, the binary, as the originator of the binary code, the father of computer science, really relates to the Baroque, the curvilinear within the whole gridded thing. So I continued to make the work where I would start to, because I had been folding the pieces, unfolding them, and then I would, for the month in between the periods, once I was back in New York, and then I went back to Europe, so it went on for 2-3 years, this project, I would move the folded pieces on linen or paper around in the studio on a regular basis daily until I saw something come out of them. So that was about the body painting through the consciousness of allowing something to come in and go out, the transfigurative, the transformative, the women's role as the initiator of transform and transfigure. And everything comes from the woman's blood not the men's blood. So the idea of the blood is, you know, very profoundly ancient, as we all know. But as a woman, it was also about my own inability to be in my body. So that was always a struggle for me. I had to really work very hard at that. And when I was in my mid-30s, I was diagnosed with cancer for the... I've survived too many times, only the good die young. But, you know, I had a lot of really great people who saved my life, and I went very deep into the holistic, and I had to pretty much move in to the package. And so that was in my mid-30s, and that informed my work, and it informed my expression as a woman, and sort of a woman who's, again, back to what is the role of the women and their ideas of power, and not the men's idea of power and wealth. But so that work really preceded another part of my life where I was diagnosed again, and then I had some other life-saving surgeries, and you know, I was brought into surgical menopause because I was 52 and I was still creating some of this blood work. And so that was the end of that. So when you look back on that, that's another kind of process of an archiving of a part of my life, just like all the beaded rubber or the performance with rubber, which is a reference not only to Eva Hess, but to, you know, the skin and the flesh. And how do you find body, mind, and spirit? How do you function? How do you survive? How do you continue to operate as a cipher? You know, and coming and going and in and out. And so those are amazing. And then I would just move them all around. And then I kind of did the felting and I did the beading. And, you know, there's a lot about the evolution of the human condition. I think landscapes, wildlife, birds, overview, those are like two samurai warriors there. That's kind of the story of like from the black hole through to the stars constellation, you know. So
now
it's a little heavy duty, that work for people, but you know,
let them enjoy.
Menopause and read my beads. So I did a beautiful edition of the text I wrote very much in the beginning when I decided to make that body of work, and the text is there to kind of inform people what the work is about.
What can we expect from the second installation?
Well, the second, there's things that are going to remain. My body paints and my blood, my whatever it's called, that piece in the center of the room. And thank you to Walter and Stephen for those incredibly beautiful vitrines they loaned me from their collection, which I couldn't have made that as beautiful without that loan. And I think they're from the Museum of History in New York, New York Museum of History. So those, that center hall will not change. There will be adapting elements to the VIP lounge, and this kind of vitrine wall here with a lot of the visual relationship between marketing my company but using myself as the muse and the tableau. So all the ads, I mean, I could have had a very successful ad agency. Clearly, I'm really good with copy. I certainly have a lot of ways of putting myself together and getting out of the house. So that, with the vitrine, it kind of gives an underpinning of the whole trajectory. But pretty much the rest of the room will all change, and there isn't anything figurative in it. So it's all very very abstract work, mostly grounded in metaphysics and geometry, a lot of geometry, a lot of, you know, there's painting and prints it's just a very much more kind of like the opposite of this kind of narrative. It's a little bit more of a collective unconscious narrative. So it's, I always was fascinated by geometry. As I mentioned, the counting was seminal to my survival. I mean, I'd count frames, I'd count bricks, I'd count cars, you know. And so numbers are huge in my work. And so it came down to a period in the 90s when I was kind of moving away, and when that work was going on, the other side of that work, body-mind, I started to think, what are my weaknesses in my practice? Drawing was one of them. So I go, okay, well, what am I going to draw? I'm not that into people, really, in the big picture, so people wasn't that interesting. So what am I going to draw? What am I interested in? So I started drawing the numbers. And I drew a series of numbers, mandalas, 1 through 9, that is called Enumerate. And that was part of a transitional work. Like, the numbers were kind of after I took all the archive from the Jungle Red, the shoe wall. I made a sculpture of the shoe wall. I just made a color labyrinth with the hundreds of pairs of shoes on a 16-foot cyclone fence. That's a print there. I took all the cards. So it was like an archival of filing the Jungle Red, which I'd closed in 89, and then moving into what was my own creative work. So the numbers was, what does it come down to for me? The number drawing, it took me a year to draw 9 numbers. I only drew 2 numbers twice. Number 2 was the one number I drew twice. And in numerology, I'm a 2. What are you? What's your birthday?
August 21.
Okay. Oh, wow. Leo.
Yes.
Oh, fabulous. So you are 8 and 2 is 10 and 1 is 11 and 1 is 12 and 9 is 21. And what was the last 2 digits? 19 what?
53.
Okay. So 21 and 5 is 26 and 3, right? 26 and 3 is 20. 26, okay, and 3 is 29, which is reductive. 2 and 9 is 11. 11 is 1 and 1 equals a 2. You're the same as me, but you are more advanced because you are an 11 functioning as a 2. And all the double digits, 11, 22, 33, 44, are very particularly, like, gifted as giving the largeness of whatever their true nature kind of, and you are that giving, loving person. We are blessed to have you in our community. So you're a 2 and I'm a 2, bro. And so that body of work became about, okay, so what's my practice about now? What do I have to work with? And it came down to something you'll see in the exhibition. It's called The Fours. And there are a series of beautiful prints I've made. And the process, it really was defined as my practice at the time conceptually was...
We're actually getting down as to numbers about 44 seconds away from ending the program.
So it's practice, it's a practice, process, form, and archive. And that is kind of what is in all of the both installations. So you'll see it represented in a different mirror.
That's terrific. Well, Francine Hunter McGivern, thank you very much for this lovely hour. We're here at the Hudson Hall at the historic Hudson Opera House in Hudson, New York. Francine, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chad. You're a treasure.